All right, stay on schedule. We'll call the both meetings, the regular and the supplemental, to order and recess the supplemental meeting at this time. We can go to the next first slide there, John. Okay, if we just take a moment of silence for those officers and firefighters who retired firefighters who passed during the month of May. Okay, thank you. Next on our agenda is the approval of minutes. You've seen we got both the public meeting from May 14th as well as the regular meeting. Does anybody have any comments or changes to either of those? Hearing none, can we just get a motion to approve? If you say your name when you say the motion or second.
Susan, so move.
Okay, thank you.
Tina, second.
Tina, second. Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Okay, anybody opposed? I think that may be a lot easier way to do this with the virtual. Okay, nobody opposes. Okay. Let's go to the detailed consent agenda, John.
Yeah, we don't put that on the screen.
Okay. Two things then before. Anything unusual in there, Kelly, that we should be aware of?
The only thing that's a little bit unusual is in the month of June, we always put the earnings test for disability people. And in June, we include the people that have passed the earnings test, meaning their disability payment will not be reduced based on their outside earnings. So you'll see that list of people. When you see the July consent agenda, there'll be a few people on there where their disability retirement is reduced because of their outside earnings. But it's unusual, but it's not unusual for June.
Okay.
And then I think Tina had something to say.
Yeah, I was going to go to that next.
Oh, okay. I just want to take a moment to talk about one of the retirees today. His name is David Barber. He's otherwise known as Woody Barber from 53s. He's the man that, I'm sorry to be so sentimental this morning, but it's just a big deal for our family because he's the person that pulled Jeff out of that fully involved fire back in 2014. So, you know, and it was virtually a miracle by any standards. And had he not, today would be a very different day for me and my family. Woody is a good man, a man of faith, and every time our family tries to, you know, show our appreciation, he seems to be more humbled by our efforts. So I would be remiss if I didn't single out Woody Barber because he's the reason why I'm here today. He's the reason why I'm on the board, and he's a constant reminder of the work and important work we do to ensure the future of people like him. So thank you for letting me say that and be sentimental, but I would be very remiss if I didn't mention his name.
Thank you for sharing that, Tina.
Thank you, Tina. Yeah. That's very nice.
Bill, I think Armando would like to say something as well.
We should reflect that in our minutes there.
Bill, I think Armando would like to also say something.
Okay, sure. I didn't hear. Go ahead, Armando.
Oh, I just sent her a private text. But, yeah, I just want to echo what Tina said. And coming from there's nothing better than saying or hearing from a fellow firefighter that dude is a damn good firefighter. And he proved it that day. And he made a difference. And he's the reason that we all get up and come to work every morning and push forward because of his actions. He was ready to do his job. He did his job, and he is. He's one of the best. I've worked with him side by side, fought many fires with him, and Tina hit the nail on the head. And, you know, we're losing a good one, but the one thing that I take solace in is that he's passed along to to the younger generations what it means to be a firefighter. So thank you for indulging me, and I echo exactly what Tina said.
Good. That's really great, and I think we should reflect those comments. So thank you both for that.
Uh-huh. Thank you.
We need a motion to approve the rest of the consent agenda.
So moved, Gilbert.
Thank you, Gilbert. Second?
Second, Alan.
Alan, thank you. Anybody opposed? Okay, it carries then. Okay, the next item is our public comment section. Is there any, John, do you want to give instructions if anybody wants to make a comment?
Yes, if you'd like to make a comment, press 5-star.
Okay. Anybody there, John? Any comments?
I do not see any.
Okay. We can move on then to our next item. Next item is, Kelly, do you want to lead us in? And Jeff Siegel, Jeff Williams from Siegel is on the line as well. So do you want to give us an intro into this, Kelly?
Sure. Thank you, Bill. So as the board will remember, at the last board meeting in May, Jeff Williams and Caitlin from Siegel presented their five-year experience study. And in that process, they recommended a whole bunch of modifications to the assumptions that are used in the actual evaluation. The assumption changes really are pretty wide-sweeping. Some of them don't have material impact, but they are changes to reflect both kind of the experience of our plan that we had in the past 5 years and what they anticipate will happen going forward there in the areas of economic and demographic information. What I've included in your materials is just the summary pages, the executive summary of all of the different assumption changes, the current assumption as well as the proposed assumption. The full report is available both in your board materials from last month and on the website. So we had a long discussion last month on these assumptions. And we also talked about the discount rate and the assumed rate of return, that assumption. And Siegel didn't make a specific recommendation on that. However, they did provide information on if we change the number, which we currently use a 7.25% percent for our discount rate, if we lowered that to a 7, 6.75, and 6.50, what the impact of that would be on various measures in the in evaluation, and I've included that page for you as well. So just I don't really have a formal presentation that Jeff is planning to do, but he's available to answer any of the questions that you might have on the assumptions we talked about last month and also on the discount rate assumption. Jeff, did you want to say anything before we open it up to questions?
I really don't have anything new to add. I'm primarily here for questions. I mean, we do recommend lowering the rate to at least 7%. But other than that, we provided three different rates for comparison purposes. And I mean, I think the assumptions we recommended will better reflect what's happening in the plan and what's anticipated to happen in the future. It really boils down to the comfort level with the discount rate.
But I think what we talked about last month was that if we do lower the inflation rate, it's very consistent to then lower the investment return. So going from 275 to 250, we would then take the investment return assumption from 7.25 to 7. Now, we did send a letter to both the appropriate people at the city and BRB and the legislature just to let them know we were talking about this and we're potentially going to move in this direction, and really have gotten very little feedback on that. But at least I felt we needed to give them a heads up in case anybody had a strong opinion. Does anybody have anything they want to add from the board before we make a motion to adopt these assumptions with that one major change?
Bill, this is
Nick.
Go ahead.
I just think that we should make sure and air amongst us all the potential implications of this. I think it makes sense, given the reality, to go ahead and lower it. But, you know, just thinking, and I think everyone should just be prepared and aware that it's likely, whether it's the newspaper or the state legislature or, you know, any sort of interested group who will take a big picture look at, you know, the last 3 years and say, the headline is that, you know, we're going backwards, because, you know, the percentage, you know, of what of our assets to our liability is kind of headed in the wrong direction. And we just need to kind of be aware and prepared, you know, for that. You know, reflecting back on the time, Bill, that you and I spoke with that ad hoc committee of the pension, the part of the legislature, the pension committee. And, you know, I think both of us walked away thinking that most of those people on that committee thought that the legislation had solved the crisis, not created a bridge for a few years to give us a chance to potentially solve it. And so I just think we all need to be ready for the potential for some very negative blowback from one of many different constituencies for this change from a headline perspective and what it does to the big numbers that people look at the most.
Yeah, I think that's right. Now, we did send a letter to Flynn, who was the chairman of that committee, and his assistant, his chief of staff as well, so that we were trying to make sure they were well aware of that. The other thing I would add is that almost all pension funds, including, I think it's Texas Employee Retirement System, have made moves in this direction, and I think it's just a reflection of the reality of lower inflation, lower investment returns going forward. But I don't think we're out there by ourselves going in this direction. So, but I think that everybody should be aware of that. You're correct, Nick.
I agree with you.
This is Alan.
I think a lot of pensions are going in that direction. So, I mean, from what I'm hearing anyway as well. And let me ask you a question. Like, will some of the, you know, cause and effect be, like, blurred with COVID-19 anyway? I mean, like, people will say this is a response to something like that as opposed to the interest rate. I mean
so, it shouldn't be. I mean, it's a long-term assumption, and hopefully we...
I agree, but as far as headline, people will think, you know what I'm saying? It's just, it's talking about the masses. Kelly, you were about to say something?
So I was going to say, you know, I think Nick is right, and you're right, Tina, that the fact that, you know, the newspaper's never going to get it right. They only have so much space and time to talk about pension matters, and they're complicated. So they typically will go with, you know, one headline number, and that's never going to tell the whole story. So it's something we have to be cognizant about and try to continue to, you know, inform our members, but I can tell you that's really hard to do because we've tried, and it still is really difficult to get some of these concepts across. And, you know, one of the things that I would say if I was, you know, given the opportunity and people had more than 5 seconds, you know, to air the issue is changing this discount rate doesn't change the cost of the benefits. The benefits are what the benefits are. The cost of the plan is what the cost of the plan is. So the only thing that we're doing by changing this assumption is to truly reflect what we think the cost of the plan is. And doing anything else is really not being transparent, and that's not what we're trying to do. We've worked really hard, you know, over at least the past 5.5 years since I've been here, to try to tell the members exactly where we stand, whether that's good, bad, or ugly, and sometimes it's difficult. But how that story gets across, I think, you know, will be a challenge. And, I mean, there's been a recent article that's been going around, and I haven't dignified it on our webpage because I think it will just be more negative, where we are reported as only having a few years of funding left. And what they've done is a calculation of if we had no new contributions and we paid out benefit payments, how long would that last? I mean, that's just a ridiculous calculation. So it's hard to handle these things in the press. I think we need to reflect where the plan is the best we can and try to tell the story to those that will listen. That's kind of my two cents. With John, will you move to slide 22 just so people can take a look at the numbers if they're interested?
And while you're doing that, Alan, did you want to say something? I thought I heard you before.
Yes, thank you. I did. And it was echoing off of something you'd said. And you know, the Teamsters Pension just announced they lost over $500 million in the first quarter. So, you know, as you pointed out, this is, you know, everyone is experiencing problems. And, you know, I think that should be taking headlines. Because what we're doing here, I believe, is our job, and that's being transparent, it's being honest, and it's, you know, pointing out what the future holds, and it's a tough time. But the other thing I guess I wanted to point out or maybe clarify is if the press does contact anyone, don't they need to be referred back to Kelly?
Yeah,
our policy
speaks for the system. Occasionally, have been asked to, but I haven't actually done it. But I think, Kelly, you should have some talking points for you so that if a call comes in, you can just write out some of these issues in terms of long-term consistency, transparency, et cetera. The things you just mentioned should just have a talking point so you can give that a call.
Yeah, okay. I just wanted to clarify that in case the press contacts any individual trustee that we know then to say, hey, you know, the policy is you should know is to contact Kelly. So, okay.
Correct.
Hey, Bill?
Yes.
For the record, this is Gilbert. I mean, I want to be a team player and I'll support it, but my own view would be that we went even lower. And I won't go into all the reasons. I think Kelly said it best on transparency and what you think the plan really is. But, you know, any movement lower, I think, is appropriate.
Thank you, Gilbert. Kelly, anything you wanted to point out on this schedule?
I guess the blessing of only having a 50% funding ratio is the percentage doesn't go down as much as it would if we were 100% funded. That's a glass half full for you right there. So, you know, if we do nothing and just make all of the other changes with that Siegel is recommending at 7.25%, we would be at 43.2% funded. If we go to 7, it's 45%. 6.75 would be 47. And then, oh, sorry, I'm on the wrong line. It'd be 46% funded if we do nothing, and then it goes to 44, and basically 43% if we go down to 6.5%.
Okay, anybody else want to say anything before we call for a vote?
Yeah, this is Joe Schutz. Just a quick question on the mortality table. I see the switch to the public safety, which seems that it would make sense, but we use the old table, and if I read it right, I thought you hit the mortality 100%. It was like 368 and 368. So what's the difference in the mortality between the old table and what we're going to be using as a new table?
That's a good question. Your mortality experience was pretty, as I recall, pretty close to what was expected. We did update to a table that is based on actual public safety experience. We had considerations of maintaining the old table and just updating the salary scale. We had a lot of discussions on that internally at Siegel, and finally we decided that it would be appropriate to make the change to the public safety table. You could have kept the old table. The new table is not hurting you to make the change. Let me take a look here. It was a nominal difference making the change. And There's several reasons. First, it's only public safety experience. It depends a little bit on your auditors, too. Some auditors are pushing for the most up-to-date tables, which doesn't mean you have to make the change. but we have auditors that are more involved. You know, sometimes you listen to their feedback as well. And really, these are just, they're more up to date, and they're based solely on public safety experience, so we thought it'd be an appropriate change. But you're right, the actual experience compared to expected was pretty good for mortality. It was better than we had anticipated.
Okay.
I didn't know, Bill, if Leo or Kent wanted to weigh in. I just, you know, one of the reasons that's really compelling to me to lower the 7.25 is, number one, the capital market assumptions are lower than they used to be. Our plan is more challenging than many. It's going to take us a long time to get up to, you know, to get rid of these legacy assets. But I just wondered if you wanted to hear from Leo or Kent on their feelings about the
sure. If either one wants to add something, please do.
This is Kent. I'll go, and then I would definitely like to hear from, or I think it would be helpful to hear from Leo. He's got the broad perspective, you know, overseeing many plans. So the one thing I'll point out is that our investment return assumption is based on the long-term asset allocation, and that we eventually get there. And it does not, the discount rate does not include that ramp up. And so, you know, for that reason, there should be some downward pressure. You know, that would be something that would add a little downward pressure. Remember that we use that ramp up expectation kind of in projecting the cash flows, as I understand it. And so, you know, I think that's the main thing that, would push us down. And so I think that's the only comment I'll have right now, and I'll ask Leo for his perspective.
Yes, Kent, and good morning, everyone. As I may have mentioned at the last meeting, we conduct these asset studies every year. We look at the variety of inputs. The last time we did it with the projections with the data as of December 31, the long-term way out, 20 years out, was just about 7.25% for the fund. Since then, rates have come down, and as I mentioned last time, that 7.25 does include a big assumption on what the final payout will be for those legacy assets, which as of today comprise a bit more of a quarter of the assets, and as you know well, some could have binary outcomes. So just modifying that assumption, I think yields, you know, different ranges from something like, I think it was 4 or 5% on the low end to somewhere about 8.5% on the high end. 7.25 today is a little bit about average, just about average, maybe a tad higher, but most plans continue to lower the rate of return assumption. So somewhere between 7 and 7.25 is where the median fund is today. The trend seems to continue to go lower. Most clients I have and clients I see and talk to seem to have discussions with frequency every year or every other year to lower the rate of return assumption. So I think that is something that I think is a reasonable outcome. And, you know, I would probably not go all the way to 6.5. Either 7 or 6.75 would be the two numbers that I would consider when you weigh your decision.
Thanks, Leo. This is Ken. I just wanted to kind of get a little bit more detailed about, you know, where I would be on this, because while the assumptions that we use, and those are Makita's assumptions, you know, take us kind of closer to that 7, you know, my feeling as I look at the portfolio is that it, you know, ultimately will be something lower than that. And so, you know, and this is more of a feeling, is that it should be lower, more like the 6.75. So but that's kind of the data kind of pushes us towards 7, and kind of as I look at the portfolio, I would be more likely to expect 6.75. So I just wanted to add that final commentary. Back to you, Bill.
Hey, thanks. Any other trustees want to add anything before we go move forward with this? If not, I'll motion that we go ahead and provide direction to Siegel or to adopt the assumptions as recommended with the lower inflation rate at 2.5% and the investment at 7. And then do we have a second for that?
Rob, second.
Okay, Rob, thank you. Anybody opposed? No, okay. It carries then, okay. Thank you very much, everybody. Now, is the next item we're going on to the drop policy amendment, Kelly?
Yes, I'm sorry. Yep. Yes, the drop policy amendment. And what this is about is because we annuitize the drop balances once a member leaves active service, that is based on their life expectancy. And because we changed the mortality tables, we now need to change the drop policy to match that. So that's the only change in this policy, is just adopting the new information based on Siegel's recommendation.
Okay. Any discussion? Okay. Somebody want to motion that, please?
Susan, so move.
Thank you, Susan. Second?
Armando, second.
Armando, thank you. Anybody opposed? Okay. Then it carries. Go ahead. Next, we're going to recess the regular meeting and go to supplemental meeting to do a couple of items, similar items, basically. The first one is the approval of the minutes. We have those on the screen if we can. It's approval of minutes first from the last meeting. Anybody want to motion that?
So moved, Susan.
Okay, thank you, Susan. Second?
Alan, second.
Alan, thank you. Anybody opposed? Okay, carries. And then it's also the approval of the service retirements. And I'll move we approve those. Does somebody want to second that?
Tina, second.
Tina, thank you. Any opposed to that? No. Okay, that carries. And that gets us to the actuary evaluations assumption. Kelly, you want to cover it? This is the first item is the same as we just covered, isn't it?
Right, and we should keep the valuation assumptions the same as we do in the regular plan, unless there's a compelling reason not to. And really, Siegel hasn't recommended any differences, just because the plan size of participants is just too small to be able to kind of stand on their own for assumptions. So adopting the same motion that you did in the regular plan would just make sure that all the assumptions are the same for both the regular plan and supplemental plan.
Okay. Do I get a motion? Somebody want a motion that we keep things consistent?
Alan, move.
Thank you, Alan.
Susan, second.
Who is that?
Susan.
Susan, thank you. Anybody opposed? Okay. These are harder to do with virtual meetings. Okay, next is the funding policy to adopt, amend the funding policy. Kelly or Jeff, somebody want to go over that with us?
Yes, I'll talk about this. So as you may recall, in December of last year, we adopted a funding policy for both the regular plan and the supplemental plan. And at the time, we had to do it to meet a January deadline that was imposed by the legislature to put this funding policy in place. And the rules of the funding policy are that it has to result in a funding plan that gets to 100% funded. But our supplemental plan was funded based on a rolling 10-year funding plan, which a rolling plan or an open funding policy will never reach 100% funding. It just won't, because you're only funding one-tenth of the unfunded amount every year. So it didn't meet the qualifications. We went ahead and adopted the plan at that time because it reflected the reality of the way the city was funding the plan and also what was in the actuarial evaluation. And when we did that, we knew that we would come back and change this. So I've been working with the city on a new funding
plan for how we would fund the supplemental plan, and we've come to an agreement that they are acceptable with, where we would change the funding policy. And one of the things I wanted to mention is the one that was in your packet was not the correct plan, and so I'll tell you where the changes are. But to start with, so you might want to look in Diligence or what's on your screen instead of if you're looking at the PDF. So, John, can you go to the next page? There we go. I'm sorry. Go to the first page, 261. So the first page, the only changes here are just some cleanup. I had the combined plan instead of the supplemental plan. The original one I put in there, I said it would be funded by 2041. It's actually 2040. Please go to the next page. So the main change here is this item in D3. And what we're doing now, instead of funding this the supplemental plan on a rolling 10-year basis, what the city wanted to do, and I think it's an acceptable solution, is we would fund the existing liability in a closed 20-year period, and that existing liability will be as the liability that comes out in the 1/1/20 evaluation. And then any future liabilities, gains or losses due to investments or method changes or assumption changes, those will be funded over a closed 10-year period. So by 2040, the existing liability will be completely funded, and then all new liabilities that come up will be funded over a 10-year period. That's the main change in this funding policy, and that's consistent with the one that's in your packet.
How underfunded is this plan now? You know, how much are we going to be amortizing over the 20 years?
So I think the unfunded amount, I don't have it in front of me, but I believe it's $23 million. I don't know if you have
Actually, Kelly, the 2019 valuation, the unfunded was $13.5 million.
No, $13.5 million. So it's a small amount. So what this funding policy will do for the, as far as the city's contribution means, is it's going to result in a lower contribution for them in the early years and then a higher contribution in the later years. But in addition to doing this, they've also agreed to fund the amounts that are due to that we have to pay out of the excess plan, which in the past we've just had to pay those out of the supplemental contributions. So that's in addition to the plan. So that's currently about $300,000 a year. John, will you go to the next page? So what I've done on this G1, this is the paragraph that is different in the version that you had, and it's just a wording change. It's not really any substance. The requirement from the PRB is that we include a guideline to lower future contributions in this policy. And what I had in here before was really a match of what it said in the regular plan. However, that was really based on what the 6243A-1 says for the regular plan, but there's no requirement here where we can't lower the contributions from the city if we want to. So what I did was I just left this up to the board can do that as long as we're within the PRB guidelines. You don't, you know, ever have to, but you've got that flexibility. And then as far as the employee contributions go, they always need to match what's in the regular plan. So this refers back to the regular plan and the statute. And really, those are the only changes. Are there any questions on this?
Who is in this? The people that earn above a certain level that wouldn't be qualified in the regular plan?
Yes. What happens is if you are a police officer, firefighter, in the regular plan, it only includes your salary up to your highest civil service rank. So once you become promoted above a civil service rank up to kind of what we call the chief level, then your salary above that level is what's in this plan. So for most people, it's a small part of their pension is paid out of the supplemental plan and the bulk of their pension is paid out of the regular plan. The only difference is in a case where, you know, for example, the current police chief, she came in as a chief, so her whole entire
pension will be paid out of the supplemental plan. But, you know, that's fairly unusual. Typically, most of their benefit comes out of the regular plan.
Okay.
There's about 120 participants in the plan.
Okay, any other questions? Okay, I'll move that we adopt the funding policy change. Do I have a second?
Alan, second.
Thank you, Alan. Anybody opposed to the change? Okay, it carries. Next, we're going to adjourn the supplemental meeting. We've got that done, and go back to the regular meeting. So we need a motion to adjourn.
Correct.
Somebody want a motion?
So moved.
Okay, thank you. Second?
Second.
Okay. Anybody opposed to adjourning? Okay. Hearing none.
Who made the motion? I'm sorry.
Pardon me?
I didn't catch who made the motion.
I did.
Oh, you did, Bill. Okay, thank you. And Jeff, thank you for being on the call, and I don't think we'll have any more questions for you today.
Okay. Well, I'm going to sign off in. If you need me, just text me.
Thank you.
All right, thanks. Have a good day, everybody.
Thank you, Jeff. Can you give us the page number reference back to Brenda's report? Or where
45.
We are? What? Which one?
45.
45. Okay, thanks. Okay, Brenda, go ahead.
Thank you, Bill. This morning, I just want to provide you with a status update on our annual audit. The initial field work for the audit has been completed, and it was performed 100% remotely. We have completed approximately 70% of the PBC auditor request and submitted those to them. They, in turn, have done sampling, and we have provided all of the additional testing information that they needed. All of the confirmations that the auditors have sent out have been received, except for the legal and actuarial confirmations, and those are typically sent closer to the end of the audit. Member census data that is used for the actuarial report has been submitted to BDO so they can begin their review of the census data even before the actuary report is completed. Our largest item that is outstanding is some audited financials from a few of our investments. A couple of the names are familiar, Lone Star and Huff, kind of our perennial laggards in this category. We have one other investment, and we expect to get that audited financial just any day. Once we receive the remaining investment financial statements, then we will be able to submit information to the actuaries for the actuarial report. And once that information is submitted, it'll take approximately 60 days from then to have the financial statements completed. In the meantime, all of the accounting financial staff are already working on the portions of our audited financials that we can complete now. There's quite a few tables. We have the information for that, so we're working on that. And we're beginning the work on the CAFR as well. So trying to get ahead as much as we can while we continue to wait. Additionally, I wanted to mention that the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board issued firm inspection reports for the top six accounting firms in the U.S. on June the 1st. Our firm, BDO, is within that top six, and we are scheduling a meeting with BDO. Hopefully we'll have that set up for July for the after the July board meeting to discuss some questions that we have about that oversight or firm inspection report.
Yeah, I would add, out of the six firms, they had the lowest rating, and they had the highest deficiency rate. I think it was 52%, and some of the others were all down in the 30s and 20s, et cetera. So I think we felt that we hadn't had them explain to us why they're deficient. Now, it doesn't affect our audit at all. These are only public company audits that are measured by the PCAOB, but it is an indication of quality of auditors, and at some point in time, we're going to have to be comfortable that their quality level is high enough, or I think we're going to need to go out to bid, which we may be doing it at some point anyway, but I think we need to have that explanation. So those, Tina and Armando and Nick, the audit committee, we're going to try to schedule a call with them right after our July board meeting, but it hasn't been set up at this point in time. The other question I have, Brenda, what is our supposed requirement to submit our audit to the Pension Review Board, and do we have to notify them that we're not going to make that deadline?
We will notify them. Typically, it's due by June 30th, and you will get a 30-day grace period to July 31st. So we will notify them that we will not be able to make those dates. Kelly,
that's the GFOA deadline, Brenda. There
is
no grace period with the PRB. So the deadline for that, I believe, is actually May 31st. And in the past, we've notified them they're going to be late, and the response is, okay, thanks for letting us know, but the deadline's the deadline, so you're going to be reported as being non-compliant. So they're well aware of our issues. I talk to their executive director all the time. They know it's out of our control, but there's no leeway in the legislation to give us a grace period on that deadline. But they understand the issues, and they're expecting us to be late.
Okay. Unfortunately, that's the way we've been doing this for quite a while, given the different firms, private equity firms, that can't meet their contractual obligations. Okay, any questions for Brenda? Okay, if not, Kelly, you want to cover the monthly contribution report?
Yes. Beginning on page 47 is the report that you are all used to seeing by now. This report is the June report. It's based on April 2020 data. In this report, the actual hiring at the end of April had 62 more employees in the hiring plan estimated that it would have at this point. There was 85 firefighters in excess over their estimate, and the police was short by 23. So that is good news. I do expect those numbers to drop with everything that's going on and the types of phone calls that we're receiving at this point. If you go to the next page, it's the summary data. Again, this is for April. There were three pay periods in this calculation. And for the month of April, the actual contributions were $16.5 million. That exceeded the hiring plan estimate, so it was 105% of the hiring plan estimate, or almost $690,000 more than that. It is 96% of the floor, so the floor is still being helpful to us. Since HB 3158 was effective, the actual contributions from the city have been $344,000 based on actual comp pay, and another $37.8 million from having the floor in place. So we are getting closer and closer to that floor. Currently, since inception, we're at 90% of the floor and 98% of the hiring plan. So those are good, both good news. As far as employee contributions, as you know, there's no floor. So for the month of April, we're above where the hiring plan said we would be. And since the bill was effective, we're about $2 million less. And if you put interest on that, it's a little less than $500,000. So I think we're on track. Things are going well. at this point, and hopefully the hiring with the city continues. Are there any questions about the hiring plan? Oh, I mean, I'm sorry, the contribution report?
No, that's good news. That was one of our major concerns early on, was we weren't meeting those numbers, but the trend has clearly changed, and the city is really doing a good job of hiring and making contributions that are in line with what we had hoped for.
Kelly, the raises that they've made have been. Go ahead, Tina.
Kelly, did they get a new software? Is that part of the help, or I mean, or
no,
I
the
mean,
reason
like...
the reason that they're up is really just because of the large raises that they've done and the hiring. So the raises have helped, especially the mid-career raises that were put in place. Those make a big difference, but also they are able to recruit much easier than they were. I do think, though, with all the turmoil that's going on right now, I think things will change, but luckily we have the floor in place, so we won't be impacted as much as we may be if we didn't have that floor in place.
Now, you say that. Are you hearing that there's maybe higher turnover about to occur with given the environment?
Well, we're receiving a lot of calls, a lot more calls about retirement. And what's interesting is I think we have, gosh, I counted yesterday, 6 or 8 people that have called to get numbers for buying their service credit. And typically I only see maybe 1 a month, and there's 6 or 8 that are in the pipeline for me to review at this time, which I've never seen before. And people can buy service credit if they have military leave or they've lost contributions because of a divorce, and people are looking to buy that time because, and a lot of them are saying because they're looking at leaving.
And
this is Joe. I've noticed that they haven't posted any new openings within the department because they're just not letting people move around. But I was tracking prior to the kind of a freeze on any kind of transfers, and there seems to be a pretty big shift on hiring more civilians than sworn members. So I was kind of charting how many job openings or transfers you could do for sworn versus non-sworn, and that seems to be a trend. And then they moved everybody that was in recruiting and backgrounds out of recruiting and backgrounds for the time being, and they're just calling people back that have called 911 and that have been on hold for a long time and asking if they still need the police. So I don't know how much effort's getting put into recruiting or backgrounds right now. So I think it's going to slow down considerably, the hiring anyway.
Yeah, and I know that on the fire side, this is Armando, I know that on the fire side, we're looking at potentially not hiring a summer class like we had in the past so that we could end the year on our projected number of staffing. And then we're seeing a fewer number of retirements and fewer number of transfers. There's just not that many places to go. People aren't moving around as much. So we're keeping an eye on our side too. And I think Tina, the software that you may have been referring to is the Workday software. That's the new payroll software that we're going to be switching over to. The entire city is going to be switching over to starting this month. So I think that's what you're referring to.
Yeah, I was. Thank you.
Also, the mayor has been quoted in something I was reading it could have been the city manager. Either the mayor or the city manager was quoted as saying, you know, all city departments were going to have cuts, including the police department.
Okay.
So we'll continue them on.
Anybody else? Any thoughts before we move on to the next item? No? Okay, Kelly, you going to cover the trustee education? There isn't really anything much to cover, I don't think.
That's a good summary. There's nothing, no requests on here, so there's nothing needed on this item.
Okay. Just trying to follow our
The executive director report begins on page 226. And so what we're trying to do, the reason, just so everybody knows that this agenda is bouncing all over the place, is we're trying to do everything in open session that we can before we go to closed session. That's why we're bouncing around. Just it's helpful for the audience. So the executive director's report, again, begins on page 226. It's your typical newsletters from NCFERS and TechFERS are included. As far as open records requests go, we don't have any new open records requests that were received after the last board meeting. And it's, our response to COVID is the same as it has been. We are, however, putting a lot of effort, especially John Holt, into getting our building ready for when the staff goes back to work. We have temperature scanners in place, and we're putting in signage and directional arrows, and we're ordering plexiglass where we need to have plexiglass, and we're moving employees around, doing all those things, being prepared as much as we can for when we go back. At this point, I don't know when we're going to go back. It seems like we are able to meet all of the our customers' needs and do what we need to do remotely. What I've said in the past is I think it's most appropriate to follow the Dallas County's guideline, and they have a color-coded system. They're looking at all of the data, and currently they're still saying stay home, stay safe, which is their red color. They will move to orange once they think that things are better, and that's extreme caution. I think that's when we should consider going back. There is data on their website as well as the City of Dallas's website, and you can see that the number of cases was a low, basically, since the peak on May 25th. There was, I had it written down here, 171 new cases on May 25th. And as of June 9th, it was up to 300. So it seems like more recently, since people have been going out, we're seeing a spike in cases. So I don't have a reopening date at this point, but I think we're able to handle our customers' needs remotely. Are there any questions for me on that?
Have we gotten any complaints that we're not meeting their requirements, or is everybody pretty content with our service level?
No complaints have come to me, and I haven't heard, none of the counselors have really said anything. I do know there was one member who wanted to do a new W-4P, and he said, well, I'll just wait till I can come in and sign it, and then he just eventually just signed it. But that was the only issue. I'm not sure that's really rises to the level to be called an issue, but that's the only thing I've heard at this point.
Okay.
And we do have the receptionist is in the office, so when you call in, you get a live body, gets transferred to people. So for the member or, you know, whoever needs to talk to investments, they can't tell that people are at home versus being in the office.
Okay, good. Any other questions for Kelly? Okay, if not, why don't we go to the investment portfolio update with Kent, and I think that starts on page 54.
Thanks, Bill. And, John, we can just move right on to page 56, if you would. Thanks, John. So just a couple things to point on the asset allocation. Global equity is now up to $509 million. That's up about $25 million in the last month since the last board meeting, or actually since April 30th. Safety reserve is, you know, right about the same. It's at 259. That was 256 last time. So that held in. We did take some cash and income research to our short-term investment-grade bonds to that wouldn't have impacted the safety reserve, so that stays about the same. We are drawing down the short-term bonds as needed to support the cash. We're trying to keep the cash level at about $50 million, so we make sure we have liquidity there if we need it and if we have some kind of new market turmoil. And now that the equity markets have, you know, have rebounded pretty solidly, we will plan to use future private market distributions to rebuild cash. And one of the things we're working on, and we need to update the investment policy, is to really clearly indicate that that safety reserve is targeted for $300 million. So on a percentage basis, because the plan is down somewhat, it doesn't quite get us to $300 million. So we need to update that. And so as the money comes back from private markets, we'll put it back into short-term bonds, and then we will put it into investment-grade bonds, kind of in accordance with an implementation plan. Private markets are down a little bit in the last since the last report to 856 from or to 839 from 856. We had some valuation updates in natural resources and infrastructure. The next slide, 57, is just the adjusted asset allocation, where we go in and try to, think about what our asset allocation is. What we really think the private assets are going to be, and this gets updated as we've gotten in some updated valuations from our managers, but still kind of the big change there is in the private equity, and so no real change there. We've talked about that before, so I won't go into a lot more detail on that. Next slide, John, on slide 58 is the just performance public market estimates, and so Makita is going to give us a more detailed review. And I just try to keep you updated, you know, not minute by minute, but at least month by month, kind of where we are. And so what you can see in that middle kind of section of columns is the second quarter to date, so the April and May. And so you saw that in the first quarter, you know, global equity was down 22%, and we've regained a lot of that, but still down somewhat. So we're up 16% in the second quarter to date and down about 9% for the year. You can see overall year-to-date global equity is outperformed by 63 basis points, so a real solid portfolio. And we've talked before about the Boston Partners issue, and they're the value manager, and they're outperforming kind of versus the value benchmark. So that gives us, I don't want to say comfort, but I mean they're doing what they should do, and there's just unprecedented differences in between what we're seeing from growth benchmark and the value benchmark last year and this year as well. Fixed income up about 2.5% in the second quarter to date, so it's down 5% in the first quarter. We got about half of that back. Income research, we noticed and we thought kind of back in 2018 about how we expected to see it. Just a little bit of pressure there during a market correction, and we did see that, and as we expected and as they've done in the past, they've pretty much regained all of that in the last couple of months, really. So now just down slightly for the year, and also kind of good rebounds in some of the other fixed income managers that had been punished in the first quarter. So Brandywine and the Global Bonds, regaining a lot of what they had, still down substantially for the year. That's a lot of that is based on their underweight to the dollar. Loomis High Yields, a strong outperformance, or should say rebound in the second quarter, and outperformance in the first quarter and the second quarter, modest, but we like to see that from Loomis. We have a lot more conviction in this platform going forward. And also Pacific Asset Management, they are a higher quality bank loan portfolio, so strong outperformance in the first quarter, gave a little bit back in the second quarter, and up strongly for the year. I'll just pause for a second to see if there's any input from Greg Earlbeck on equities, and then Mike Yan on fixed income. And not hearing any. If we go to the next slide, 59 and investment initiatives. So, we continue to spend a lot of time, on private market assets, or both of our private equity issues. And one thing I wanted to mention, just thinking about the conversations we had, we have been as proactive as we can with respect to the reporting needs from the managers, and going back months, you know, into the mid-2019 into the you know, last year, late last year, kind of talking to them about what they could do to improve things. And so we're disappointed, but I didn't want you to think that we were just kind of not working on that. We've had conference calls. Kelly has reached out directly. So we have done everything we can there. We got we're expecting distribution for private markets to be slow kind of for 2020, but we did get we sold a unit in the museum tower, and we also got another distribution in May. It was June. And so we are getting a little bit back up. I think that's, and also, you know, Ryan and I were on a call yesterday kind of about with, you know, trying to work on a potential sale of a larger asset. So, and I'm talking about us, but Ryan does a lot of the work on that as well, really, Kelly and Josh as well. Okay, investment grade bond search. We're really going to talk about that in a second. So we have a recommendation today. We've spent a lot of time working on that. One of the things that we've noticed is with the high yield products, you know, and Loomis underperformance last year, is that we wanted to see if we should consider a change there. And we've spent some time surveying high yield products, and we'll talk to the investment advisory committee later this month about that and evaluate our options on that going forward. So I talked earlier about us needing to work on the IPS language, and I worked through kind of some draft language, but it really kind of left us in an awkward situation where it was difficult to rebalance. And so I've been, because unless you kind of pull out that safety reserve into its own category, you've always got a problem rebalancing. So we're working on how to do that without really changing our allocation. Let's see. I think that the other stuff is kind of things that we've identified before, but I'll ask if there's any questions about the portfolio. Okay. Also wanted to mention before I move on that one of the things we do for the investment advisory committee is whenever we have new board members come on, is we put together some investment commentary where we have about, you know, just a paragraph on each manager about what's been going on lately and kind of the key investment drivers. And so I thought since we do that for the investment advisory, there's no reason we just couldn't get a head start on that. We've included that in the other confidential material tab, and I think it's on 315 of the packet here. And anytime you want to kind of know what's going on latest with the managers, we've got it out there. I think it would be too tedious to go through kind of in the meeting, and some of it is the private market assets is sensitive. Okay, on the next slide, 60. Yeah, so it's our calendar, and we are going to have a presentation from Hancock in just a little bit. So we'll continue to move through that, and you can see the calendar for the rest of the year. So I didn't hear any questions on the investment portfolio, so it's okay. I'll move on to the investment advisory panel briefly and just we'll, this was a special meeting for the bond search, and we'll kind of cover that in the bond search, but I'll just stop for a second and ask if Gilbert, as the chair, if that has any comments on this most recent meeting.
Thank you, Kent. Yeah, I'll go fast, which is I think a lot of work went into this. I think a lot of work went into it by the consultant. A lot of work went in by the staff. The committee met. It was, well attended. In the mix, they had already gotten it down to about 6 to 8 firms. In that mix were, I think it was 3 diverse firms, which is good, just to make sure that we're not missing anything. And then we came down to 2 finalists, and I'll let Kent do the punchline, but at the end of the day, the 2 finalists, you couldn't go wrong with either one. And they presented, and I won't do the punch, I'll let Kent go through it, but one was a diverse firm, a woman-owned firm, and the other was a mainstream firm, but the reality is they were both very good firms, you could have gone either way. So that's really all, Kent. I'll kind of let you go into it. I didn't want to spill the beans, so to speak, but a lot of good work went into it, and I appreciate it.
Thank you, Gilbert. One thing I wanted to mention on the Investment Advisory Committee before we move on to the bond search is that with the way the law reads that we have to have a majority of outside members, that is non-trustees on the committee, and that and so right now we have three external members and two board members, but we also in our policy we have it written that meeting has to have a quorum with more members, and so this last couple of meetings one external person hasn't been able to attend, and so it's prevented us from kind of having an official quorum. We're still getting great feedback, and we're following our processes, but that's something that we're going to have to address as just part of the investment advisory committee. Moving on to the bond search. So,
and I just had a question. Maybe it's for Josh, but if you got four out of the five members there, why wouldn't that be a quorum?
Well, the board in the IPS determined that a quorum is at least three, but you have to have more outsiders than insiders for it to be a valid quorum, which I think is a reflection of the law, and I think that's appropriate. So that's just sort of the way it worked. This last time we had two outsiders and two insiders, and one of the outsiders, a fifth outsider, couldn't make the meeting. So that's why we ended up without an official quorum under the policy the board adopted.
Could one of the inside members recuse themselves to make it a quorum, or are we really stuck with having to have everybody there for the meeting?
Well, I guess one of the insiders could not participate. And, I think we're trying – I think the policy is a good reflection of trying to – policies obviously have to adhere to the laws that provide for their promulgation, and I think the policy is a good reflection of what the statute says, which requires that the IAC have more outsiders than insiders. Now, we've had now two meetings in a row where there haven't been more outsiders than insiders, even though the committee itself has more outsiders than insiders, but who attends meetings is different than who's on the committee. So, I think we are complying or trying to comply with the law appropriately. I just think, as Kent said, at some point either we need to have maybe more, another one or two outsiders appointed so that people can kind of come and go. Sometimes people can't make meetings, just so that we do have the appropriate number of people at the meetings.
Yeah. And, Bill, this is Gilbert. I think it's something that we can fix pretty easily. But I think for today's purposes in general, even though it may not have technically been a quorum, the bottom line is the committee met, deliberated, had presentations. There was a great deal of work, has a recommendation for the board to consider whether it was a quorum or not. And the players that were there, on average are probably 35 years in the business. So I think, maybe it wasn't a quorum, but I think that ultimately the work is valid and the recommendation holds.
I would agree. I would definitely agree. So if you think that this is like adding another person or whatever, we should consider that to just.
Yeah, I think that's right, Bill. And we should just touch base with Ray, too, so we can sort of work on that offline if that's okay.
Yeah, I've already sent Ray a note just to see if he's going to be able to make them or not going forward.
Thank you, Bill.
Thank you. Okay, go ahead.
That's it for me, Kent.
Thanks, Gilbert, and thanks, Josh. Okay, so moving on to the bond search. So first, let's talk a little bit about what why we're doing this and then how we did it. So when we put together the asset allocation in the fall of 2018, we added investment grade bond allocation, and we wanted to get that funded. It's kind of more of the safe part of the portfolio, so that's one of the higher priority items in the implementation plan, and so we established a passive investment with Vanguard to make that happen. Gilbert had suggested that it would be worthwhile to try to fill that with an active manager, and reminded us last year that we weren't really moving forward on that, and so we gave that a higher priority in the first half of the year. And so the thought here is that we can make some money by putting an active manager in place, and I think I'm very confident that the manager really any of the managers that were in our shortlist kind of could have, will outperform the benchmark over time. And so I think this was a worthwhile search. And so the next part of it is the process. And John, if you could, I've always wanted to shift things up after I think about it, but if you could shift over to page 67. And so this is, it was important that we understand kind of what our, how we were going to do this, and our process was established kind of ahead of time, and also our criteria, so we weren't kind of making it up as we go. And so this memo kind of outlines what our, the timeline we did and what the process we did, and I think if we could move forward a couple of pages there, I can't remember exactly where it is. Oh, I guess I had, I'm sorry, I think I had that at another spot. So there it is. So, and if you go to the next page, John, there. Okay, so just, this is the process that we used, you know, so we kind of defined the process, and we sent that out to the Investment Advisory Committee, and they were, you know, okay with that. And then we used Makita, or Makita established or helped us, or they provided a recommended short list. That was 11 managers, and we ended up refining that down to 6 managers that we sent out a request for proposals to. And then on those requests for proposals, we actually got 5 back. One manager, once they contacted us and we realized that they were going to have probably more high yield in their portfolio than we wanted long term, we pulled them off of kind of consideration, and they didn't respond. But we did get 5 solid managers back. And then what we did is staff evaluated those managers on our own. So we have a, you know, a model that we use to kind of evaluate them, you know, through all kinds of performance metrics. We looked at their processes and evaluated them across several metrics, including the organization, the investment team, their process and philosophy and process, their performance. And then we just kind of separately said, and we didn't really sum everything together, but just said kind of, how do we feel about these managers kind of overall, and ranked them and thought about that. And then we went back to Makita, and we put together our thoughts and said, this is how we see it. And they provided some additional context, but generally were in agreement with us. And the key thing here is that one thing that came out in the end is that staff had a preference for lower tracking error products. And so managers that weren't really, you know, ranging too far from the benchmark that were going to give us kind of the returns of the benchmark. Generally, you know, everyone underperformed in the first quarter this year, for example. So just like Income Research, we'll expect even these relatively conservative managers to underperform in times of stress, but we also expect them to get it back. And so some of the managers on the short list, which are really good managers, but they had, you know, more risk in their portfolio, more volatility and tracking error. We didn't feel like that was where we wanted to go. And so even though they may outperform over the long term, we focused on the 2 lower tracking error managers, which also had strong excess returns and alpha and information ratio. And so and those 2 managers were Baird and Longfellow. And so staff recommended those, staff interviewed those 2 managers by teleconference and then we had told we had shared with the Investment Advisory Committee along the way kind of what our evaluation of the portfolio was, and that we'd be bringing them forward, and we didn't hear any, no concerns about that. And then we had developed a meeting, or set a meeting for May 28th for the Investment Advisors, a special meeting for the Investment Advisory Committee to interview these managers by teleconference. And so, they had their meetings, and ultimately these managers are both just rock solid. I mean, it's like trying to, you know, pick between your children or something. I mean, they're both just, it's really, really good managers. And in the end, we had a slight preference for Longfellow. It's a little bit smaller firm, and we think that that will allow them to be somewhat nimbler in their positioning. They will be, and also kind of will be, you know, our mandate. It's one of the pieces of feedback from the Investment Advisory Committee, you know, will be more important to them as a client, although I think it would be important to Baird as well, but I mean that came into it. And they really had Baird had a strong presentation, but you know, Longfellow just really kind of feel just felt like those guys were really working solid together. And so that really is kind of how our analysis and our ultimate recommendation comes from. I'll stop for a second here in a minute and just ask if there's any input from staff and then from consultant in the investment advisory committee. This will be at current targets, this would be about a $78 million mandate. And the right now we have $60 million at Vanguard, so we'll transfer that over. And then as we get more money from the private markets, we'll fill that up to target. Fees will be, we negotiated fees down, fees will be about between $180,000 and $200,000 a year. Based on our historical analysis, we expect to earn double that kind of in terms of value add net of fees, so in the neighborhood of $400,000 a year. So with that, I'll check anyone from staff have anything that I want to talk about that I missed? And anyone from Akita kind of want to comment on the process or your thoughts on these managers?
Sure. This is Leon. Again, good morning, everybody. So this was a good process. It was the first time we've conducted a search for you and also working with the Investment Advisory Committee. I'll say the process was clearly established up front. And staff was very involved in interviewing all of the managers that advanced further. And ultimately, I think the recommendation is very sound. The Investment Advisory Committee was also very involved and provided good insights and observations. Ultimately, reasons for Longfellow to be the choice included the strong downside protection of the strategy together with risk management. I think the smaller and potentially more nimble asset base versus the other option, which was Baird, was the consideration. The excess return from Longfellow has been very consistent and stable. The tracking error has been low, and it's also a diverse, woman-owned entity. I think all of those ultimately were the edge. As was mentioned, the other alternative was also a very, very compelling one, but a choice had to be made. Fees were very positively negotiated to what we consider are attractive. And as Kent alluded, there is the expectation to generate, you know, double the excess return versus the benchmark that you're paying in fees. So overall, pleased with it. And I think it sets a good precedent for any future searches. Now having done one in terms of the process, how to work with it. I think overall a very rewarding process.
Do we ask for favored nation clauses on our fees for like-size accounts?
Yes. We went out to our finalists and, you know, indicated that a MFN would be required, and they both had agreed to that. And we are at an MFN. They verified that our fee level would be an MFN.
Okay.
They had to get – go ahead.
I was just going to, for full disclosure, the CEO and the founder of Longfellow was somebody I've known for a long time, and she was on my mutual fund board, actually. So I know her well. However, I was not involved whatsoever in the search or asked for any input, and I have no conflicts of interest with that firm or person. So just wanted the board to know that.
Thank you, Bill.
Yeah, and Ken, let me just disclose that I have a fund with American Beacon. I've never met her or anyone at the fund, Longfellow, but I think that they're on the board of Beacon or something to that effect, and I don't want to know. But I want to disclose that there's something there, right?
Yeah, and they were a finalist for the National Railroad Investment Trust as well, and was thought of very, very highly. They came out pretty close to the top on that review. So it's a very solid firm from my personal knowledge as well as my experience on another board that looked at them.
Yeah, and another one of our – they were a finalist at another one of our investment committee's search too. And, again, we could go either way. And, you know, I think the fact that they're smaller, I think we will mean a lot more to them. which means I think we'll get extraordinary attention from them. And of course, people know my bent. I think the fact that it's a diverse firm is a positive. So all of those things add up. I think we're just going to look at again working on fees a little bit. But I just wanted to disclose that.
Thanks, Bill and Gilbert. I meant to mention that, and it's in my notes, but I had hadn't gotten there. So thank you, Susan. Do you have any particular comments? You were active in the meetings.
Chatting to me?
Yeah, I just wanted to just open the floor to you in case you.
I thought the process was very, very thorough. It was my first venture, but staff did an excellent job, and I thought I also felt we could go either way. They were both very high quality firms, but I did tend to go along with the group that we would be more important client to Longfellow and rather enthusiastically went along with the feeling of the group to lean toward them, subject to, all of the various issues and fees that, that the group felt were appropriate.
Thank you, Susan. And Bob Jones and Scott Freeman, the external members, were also actively involved in that meeting and providing feedback. So are there any questions from the board about this before I ask for your approval of our recommendation to approve Longfellow for the 4% allocation investment grade bonds?
Doesn't sound that way. Is it safe to assume that Gilbert, you will make this motion and Susan would second it?
Correct.
Yes.
Hey, this is Armando. I have one question for Gilbert. I was reading the notes, and it said that you stated the right level on the fees. Are you happy with where the staff got to on the fees?
I think so. I think they, made movement, which is a good sign. We have a most favored nation. I think that will protect us going forward. So I think we made our move, and it worked out.
Okay. Thanks, sir. Appreciate the info.
But I appreciate the question. It can always go lower. It can always go lower. But go ahead, Susan. I didn't mean to cut you off.
I would add that the rate that staff negotiated is very competitive.
Okay. Thank you. If y'all are good with it, I'm good with it.
Okay. Sounds like we've got a motion and a second from the IAC committee members. Anybody opposed to the recommendation? Nope. Okay. Hearing none, it passes unanimously.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone. And thanks to everyone on the Investment Advisory Committee and to Makita. This is fun. Fun stuff. So moving on, I'll turn it over now to, Bill, I'll let, okay with you, we'll turn it over to Leo to talk about performance.
Yep. Go ahead.
And again, this is Leo. I will have Aaron. Aaron, are you on the call?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
So Aaron will walk us over the performance report. He's back and working again after taking a few weeks, coming back from paternity leave. Congratulations on your second daughter, Aaron. And if you had a decent night of sleep last night, please go ahead.
Thanks, Leo. Only was woken up once, so it was definitely harder on Mama than me. But if you guys could go to slide 148, please. So before jumping in, I'll just provide some high-level thoughts on what we've seen across the industry and across our client base. So during the first quarter and in the last 2 months of a bit of a recovery, generally clients have been doing a lot of monitoring, a lot of discussion, but not a lot of portfolio changes. So across the board, most clients our recommendation has been, you know, stick with your long-term asset allocation, rebalance as needed, but don't do anything crazy. And I think you guys are in the same boat and, you know, have done a good job of weathering through the volatility without making any rash moves. Here, we got the executive summary of the first quarter. So the first thing that jumps out is a lot of green relative to some of the past quarters. So the fund lost about only 7% in the first quarter. You know, relative to peer plans and your policy index, you did fantastic. So peer plans lost 13% in the quarter, and your policy index lost about 12.5%. So on a relative basis, your portfolio outperformed by, you know, 500 to 600 basis points, depending on which group you're going against. You'll see, and I'll probably mention it a number of times, it really was simply the low weight to public equities. If you go to the following page, please, you can see on a trailing 1 year, the fund is pretty much just slightly negative, and this was as of March 31st. So if you do this today, you'd be in positive territory there. But same story, great outperformance versus your policy index and against peers. So that third line, you can see peers down 6% in that period, putting you in the, you know, top second percentile group. Go one more page, please. So because of this, we're starting to even see improvement on the trailing 3-year numbers. So you can see positive on the second line relative to your policy index and an outperformance relative to peers. So just slightly above the median in the peer group, which is public pensions in the $1 to $5 billion range. I'll pause for a second. Any questions right off of that? Okay. Hearing none, I'll say, request you go to slide 153, please.
Hey, Aaron. Sorry, I was on mute. This is Kelly. So, I mean, all of that looks great, but shouldn't we have some caution in there that part of the reason that it looks great is true that we're under allocated to equities, but the other part is because the private asset valuations lag?
Certainly. And your peers will most likely have a similar, you know, be in a similar boat, but to a lesser scale. So, you know, everyone else has delayed marks there. Just assume that their portfolio probably has less exposure there.
Right, but we do have significant concentration, as the board knows, in some private equity with oil and gas and that type of thing. So I guess my point is that they shouldn't be surprised if those colors change maybe in the future, in the, you know, subsequent quarters, unfortunately.
Certainly, yeah. Yeah, and simply just the equity market rebound, you're participating less than other plans. So you'll likely see a similar impact that occurred at the end of 2018 and then the change in first quarter 2019, where you went from one of the best performing in a quarter to the bottom of the pack the next quarter.
I would just add, I think these flash summaries are very good. They're greatly improved from what we saw because it gives a more fuller picture both of what we control and what we don't control. So I think that's really good, guys. Appreciate it.
Certainly. Thank you for the feedback. So I guess to somewhat to your your point, Kelly, if you look here on this page, the asset class pie chart on the left, you can see the majority of your different asset classes beat the benchmark in the quarter, but to some extent, and you can see that on the right side, that is simply a function of the challenges in benchmarking private asset classes. So your infrastructure, which is private infrastructure, you know, has a public benchmark. So you have dramatic outperformance in the quarter as a result that will largely reverse in this current quarter. But overall, you can see, you know, the chart on the left, that your, you know, not just your portfolio, not just your managers, but the actual, excuse me, not just your asset allocation, but the strategies you're using did better than their benchmarks in the quarter. If you go forward to 163, please. So this chart breaks down where the 500 basis points of outperformance came in the quarter. It shows the blue sections are where asset allocation tilts relative to targets were beneficial or were detractive, and the green shows where manager outperformance or underperformance existed. So you can see, and it was the obvious message right up front, the top three big blue bars there, you had underweight to public equities, so you preserved capital much better in the quarter. You could likely expect this will look the opposite in the second quarter report. On the following page, you can go one more page, please. Oh, sorry, back to the one-year chart. You can see, you know, that same effect was a good tailwind on the one-year number. So you have about 400 basis points of relative outperformance on the one-year. The anomaly there is private equity, where you have that big green outperformance. That was that one large write-up in HUF that staff and the board and we've expressed concerns with. But overall, you know, this shows a nice breakdown of the trailing year showing where that outperformance has come from. And you could use this as a guide for what you might expect in future quarters, knowing what's going on in the markets now. If you go to 166, please. Yep, perfect. So at the end of the day, and this kind of ties back to your point, Kelly, there, the quarters where you've done really well are quarters that are very negative in equity markets. So particularly Q4 2018 and Q1 of 20, the quarters where you've trailed your policy index are largely strong equity market quarters. So knowing that, we'd expect next quarter you will likely underperform your policy index. But overall, if you're compounding returns, it's really important to minimize losses so that when markets rebound, you don't need to rebound as much. It's the old adage of if you have a dollar, you lose 50 cents. If that's a minus 50% return, but to get back to even, you need 100% return. So, you know, when we started building the asset allocation many years ago, you know, we were always fearful of an environment like this first quarter. So, you know, we're happy to see that the system was able to get through it without significant impairment to the long-term viability of the plan. I'll go to one more slide, and then I'll pause again for questions. If you could go, please, to 168. Okay, so the peer ranking floating chart. And again, you know, this is as of March 31st, and it's outdated, but you could see the impact of one drastic quarter takes you from really the bottom of the pack on the shorter term periods to way above the pack in the year-to-date, 1 year, and to some extent 3 year number. So you are the green dot. And if you look at the bottom in that gray line where it says DPFP, the parentheses is your ranking. Unfortunately, it doesn't do enough to get you off the bottom on the 5 and the 10 year. So there's no questions. I'll ask Leo if he wants to provide any thoughts on the private markets report.
Sure, I'll be happy to do that. Just want to make sure that that is something that the board would like to hear for 5 minutes, maybe, if so. If so, I will start.
Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead.
Okay. Okay, so we'll start on page... 1 second, let me find it. Okay, how about we start on page 150? Okay, I am looking at the wrong page number, so let me see if I can do that. So 156, let's try 156. Sorry, 156. Okay, so we started working for you about 2 years ago, give or take. At the time, the exposure to liquid assets versus illiquid assets and safety reserve was not that different, to be quite honest. So the liquid assets at the time 2 years ago was about 57% of the fund because liquidations have come slower than pace, and we had a market correction. Now liquid assets comprise 50% as of March 31. With the run-up, we're going to be probably pretty close to the point where we were two springs ago when we started working with you. If you move over one more page, here we have the composition of the legacy assets versus non-legacy. It is at $558 million, which is about $50 to $60 million above the figure 2 years ago, primarily the result of the write-up in a half private fund. So it is not truly a surprise to us. I think 2 years ago we indicated that you have to balance the speed at which you exit illiquid legacy assets versus the pricing that you want to get. There were some distribution, some of those, or maybe the majority came from other non-legacy private assets. But the reality is that these remains essentially unchanged. There may be some corrections, which we may see in the evaluation, the marks in your private portfolio in the next quarter. But by and large, the portfolio has not really changed that much in the private area. So I just wanted to highlight that. If I recall, when we were bidding for your business and then we started working, there was a game plan, and the numbers back then projected that we'll be at about
5% of the assets in this area. Obviously, it hasn't happened. We're somewhat, you know, given our experience with other clients, thinking that that was perhaps a bit optimistic, but, you know, hoping for the best, you knew the portfolio better. So a bit sad that this hasn't materialized. This remains on the books, and it certainly remains a big, big priority. And I know staff works really hard, and something that, you know, we want to see come through. So now I'm going to ask to start on the private markets report, which is, you know, about 20 pages ahead on the first page there. Let's see when we're there. Okay, so here are the assets. The composition, again, hasn't changed that much. Private equity increased a bit as a result of the markup in the one fund. And again, if you were to go to the next page, here you see the performance by the major categories within the private assets. And again, the ag area, agricultural area, is the one that performed really well. The total multiple on your investment is about 3.5 times the return on your money, including what's come back to you in distributions versus what remained in the books. The rest,
Leo,
essentially, yes.
At the top of the page, you have DPI and TVPI. Can you define those?
Yes, the first one is distributed amount as a relationship to the paid-in capital. So the amount of money that you put, what has come down. And so the blue line represents that, okay, with your agriculture investment, you put $1, you got about $2.20 back. The green line includes that amount plus whatever is your fair market value today that remains in the books. And
got
so
it.
For your agricultural investment, that's the total value to pay it in capital, and that's about 3.5 times. When you look at the rest of the portfolio, infrastructure, private equity, real estate, timber, you essentially merge all that together and you get about one. So you put $1, you have $1 today. Some of that has come back. Some remains on the book. Some sub-asset classes perform a bit better. Some perform a bit worse. But, you know, that's not what you want to see. Is what you see on the left with agriculture. What you see on the right is essentially the cost of not performance within your private markets portfolio. That money could have been invested elsewhere, generating returns, you know, about 7% a year on average, which is what the expectation should be for your fund. And so that is, you know, a reflection of, you know, some that hasn't worked in the execution of the strategy here.
Okay, thank you.
No
and Leo, I just wanted to point out that this whole report is only our active investments. So when we sell something, it drops out of this chart and drops out of this report.
You're right. Thank you for bringing that up, Brian, and pardon me for my my statement that was not accurate nor complete.
You're good.
Okay. So to wrap up this area, you have the next section, which is similar, but you'll see it on the next page on not just multiples, but also on IRR, the internal rate of return. Again, you'll see, you know, pretty close to one. The only exception is agriculture, compounding at about 15% per year. So that's quite nice. We can skip the next couple of pages and go to the private equity page, which is 189. And what you see there is, if you were to look at valuation towards the middle of the page and you scroll down, you're going to see two big numbers. One is for Half Energy at $187 million, and the other one for a bunch of Lone Star funds, most importantly the CRA. So those two comprise about $250 million of fund assets in just two investments, a bit more if you add other Lone Star and Half vehicles. So a big portion of your private equity portfolio and your legacy assets, again, is comprised of just a handful of vehicles. So that ties with my prior comment about the binary outcome. It's not very diversified, and it's going to be heavily dependent on these two portfolios primarily. And then moving on, let me see. I think probably that's a good place to end. The rest, there's not been a lot of change. Our, you know, infrastructure or real estate, not a lot of change in terms of the performance or anything noteworthy. So I won't take much more of your time. I know the staff is working hard with these two general partners and with other resources to try to move and liquidate and exit these positions. So I will stop here and address any questions if there are any from the board or staff. Hearing none, I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Leo. Thank you, Aaron. Appreciate it. Okay, next on our agenda, we're right on schedule, apparently, is our Hancock presentation. Are they on the phone, Ryan?
Rick, you and your team there?
So this is Kent. Let me just – hold on. This is Kent. I want to just – Chief Investment Officer, I just want to give a quick intro, and then, Ryan, I want to make sure you can kind of intro it from there. But the one qualifier I always want to – make before we talk about Hancock is that we have, a number, really all of our private market assets we're trying to sell. And this is, Hancock is good, and we're not trying to sell it. I always want to make that differentiation. We have a 5% allocation here. It's a 20-plus year relationship. You know, it's been very, very successful for DPFP. And so with that, I'll turn it over to Ryan to kind of give the overview and then lead into the presentation. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Kent. I'll just give a quick overview of the portfolio where it sits. John, can go to 204. So Hancock is our ag manager. We've had this portfolio since 1998. When they refer to PMPC, that is the acronym, that's the name for the portfolio. $91 million, as Kent said, kind of makes up the bulk of our natural resource portfolio. 5% of the total fund, so talk about this portfolio would stay, and that fits right into the 5% long-term allocation we have for that asset class. Since 98, the inception, the IRR is about 15%, and as Leo just alluded to on that chart, the total value to paid in capital is 3.45. So this portfolio used to be, you know, $170 million or so, and in 2016, along with all our private assets, we developed a hold-sell plan in coordination with Hancock, and they've executed really well towards that plan and actually completed, I think, with the last sale or two in 19, the final properties of the sell portfolio. So 16 properties sold, $70 million in proceeds coming back to DPFP since 2016. The go-forward portfolio, which is the current portfolio, approximately $85 million in NAV that kind of fluctuates up and down based on working capital needs and how much cash is at the property and harvest cycle. One thing to keep in mind about the whole portfolio, it is very concentrated in permanent crops that are in nuts in California and along with one apple property in Washington. How we kind of got to this whole long-term portfolio is we looked at all the portfolios, all the properties we had in the portfolio, and Hancock did a go-forward return analysis, and anything kind of in that 10% go-forward range, we decided to hold. So with that, I'll turn it over to Rick and his team to go into more detail on the portfolio, the history, and the ag market in general.
Thanks, Ryan, and thanks for having us. It's obviously an unusual circumstance. I always prefer to be there in the room with everyone, but trust that everyone's safe and healthy and managing the current circumstance as well. It's not often that we get such a great welcome or segue, but I certainly appreciate the kind words that Ryan and Ken just led into this conversation. So my name is Rick Bodio. I've been with the ag team at Hancock for a decade. About half of that time, I was focused on managing portfolios and leading our client team, and so I've spent a lot of time on this account. Today, I'm stepping in for a colleague, Kate Harkness, who has just an unavoidable conflict, so I'm stepping in lieu of the portfolio manager that does spend every day focused on this account and a small number of other accounts. My day job at Hancock is leading a separate ag investment strategy, but I am quite familiar with this portfolio and happy to be here again. I'm joined by my colleagues, Steve Ponder, Carl Evers, and Dan Cerna. They're members of our client ops and research team, and today we'll walk through the current status of the TMPC portfolio and look ahead to the future. So if we could jump to slide 207 in your diligence pack, we'll start with a brief overview of H&RG. We are a wholly owned subsidiary of Manulife Financial Corporation. Manulife is a life insurance company based in Canada. We are part of their private markets group and benefit from global resources and, you know, the depth of the team that a large financial institution brings to bear. But otherwise, we are very much a self-governing organization. We are led by sector experts and have a very large footprint of operational pros on our team, and one of them, Carl, is on the call here today. At H&RG, we have two main strategies, timber and ag. Both of our teams have extensive and industry-leading track records. Our operating footprint spans three continents. Timber and ag are combined in U.S., Canada, and Australia. Timber is in New Zealand and Chile, and on the ag side, we spent a lot of time developing our South American platform. And at the end of the day, we think our competitive advantage is our global reach and operating skill. We think our results have historically proven that, and we think that's really, you know, one of the factors that has contributed to the performance of this portfolio over time. We move on to slide 208. I'd like to take a brief moment to outline the history of the account and the main parameters to which we're managing the account today. This portfolio started in 1998 with a relatively small allocation on permanent crops. And I'll just point out that the decision to invest in ag in 1998 and the focus at that time to invest primarily on permanent crops is a very big reason for the outstanding performance of this account. Over time, there was additional capital allocated in 2000, 2005, 2009. For most of that time, the primary strategy in this account has been, at least as I would describe it, more of an absolute return concentrated investment approach by focusing on permanent crops. Although in 2009, there was an allocation added to the account to really kind of diversify or add a little bit more stability through row crops. This portfolio performed very well through 2015. At that time, we took direction from, as Ryan said, we took direction from the pension system to institute a sales process. And, you know, the net effect of that sales process was to remove all the row crops in the portfolio and permanent crops that may need investment or redevelopment in the short term. And so you can see how, as Ryan said, we've sold about 16 properties over time and some investments in Australia since that sales process was initiated, and that's generated about $70 million of net proceeds in that sales process. If we move on to slide 209, we can start taking a look at how the portfolio has done over time. You saw some of this in those last slides from Makita, so the numbers here will look the same. Over time, you've had about $80 million of contributions. We've been able to distribute about $165 million, and that's how you get to that distributions to paid-in capital of about 2.2. When we consider the residual value of the assets, that multiple increases to just short of 3.5. You know, I can confidently say I've had the opportunity to manage almost all of our portfolios at one point in time, and I can confidently say that this portfolio is a standout amongst all of our client relationships and portfolios. This level of return over a long term is, you know, I think the envy of a lot of allocators in farmland. If you track your performance on a time-weighted measure, you look at the column chart here on the bottom of this table, on an after-fee basis, since inception, return, you're looking at about a 9.6 total return over the life of the vehicle, driven primarily by the income generation of permanent crops. This is about what you'd expect from a permanent crop portfolio: high income return component, low appreciation component. And so this portfolio has kind of walked and talked and acted as you'd expect a predominantly permanent crop portfolio would perform. The last 5 years have certainly seen weaker performance. That's due to some redevelopment activity, as well as the disposition program and timing, which just generally led to some weaker returns. Some of that is due to math and a time-weighted calculation. Some of the row crop properties that were sold, you know, at or below appraised assets, so that triggered write-downs. Those are generally all transacted at positive rates of return or gains to book value, but the way that they transacted below appraised value often led to some weaknesses, which have been a drag on the portfolio in the shorter term. Nevertheless, if you measure the performance of the portfolio on an IRR basis, IRR is about 15%, and that includes the current residual value. So really, by any measure, we look at this portfolio and think it's done very well over the longer term. You know, as we carry on here, if we move to slide 210, we can start looking forward to the portfolio's anticipated performance over in the future. The portfolio remains a very strong portfolio with good permanent crop assets. As Ryan indicated, you know, what's really left here is a portfolio of 8 farms, principally located in the San Joaquin Valley of California. And then there's an asset in Washington that produces apples. Collectively, the return on these farms have been significant, and we expect them to remain significant performers going forward. As you look forward, as you look at some of the graphics on this slide, you'll see that, you know, the assets that you've held, or that you still hold, they have been the primary income generators for your portfolio. They will remain primary and strong income generators for this portfolio. But, you know, it should be stated in the next couple of slides here, we'll talk a little bit about the fact that it is a concentrated portfolio. There are risks around tree nut prices, water availability primarily, and to some extent labor, particularly for your apple investment. And those are the risks that we're focused on managing to maintain the performance of this portfolio going forward. If we move to slide 211, you know, some kind of general reasons why farmland makes sense, and we still think it makes sense for your particular portfolio. Farmland has historically been negatively correlated with major financial asset classes, and so it tends to provide diversification to large institutional investor or institutional portfolios. It's also performed well in inflationary periods. We also think the market fundamentals remain positive for farmland. The population continues to increase, and globally, despite the current economic environment, the middle class continues to expand, eating habits continue to improve, and arable land and water remain scarce. And so when you combine all these factors, it remains farmland remains attractive for investors like the police and fire pension. Typically, farmland provides stable returns. There's, you know, annual cash yields that are reasonably predictable. They're not perfectly predictable, clearly, but they are reasonably predictable, and so they tend to provide fairly stable cash yield. And in moments of overall market stress, farmland tends to be an asset class that does well. That's clearly no guarantee, but it tends to do well primarily because consumers still need to eat, and there are limits to the globe's ability to produce and trade these food products. And so farmland tends to do well even when other markets are doing less well. You know, nevertheless, you know, I suspect that the board would like to hear about our view of farmland going forward. So I'd like to throw it over to Dan Cerna for the next couple of slides. So, Dan, take it away, please.
Thank you very much, Rick. Can everyone hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay, excellent. It's good to be with you all. And we're going to move forward to slide 212, I believe. Just wanted to touch on kind of what's taken place the last few months with COVID and the severe contraction in the global and U.S. economy and some of the impacts as it affects agriculture. And then we'll get more specifically into the crops where you're invested as well. But broadly, agriculture has remained pretty resilient to some of both the demand and supply shocks that have affected the global economy from business closures and social distancing. I think also I want to start off by making the broad comment that the impacts to agriculture have been most acute for those products which are fresh or perishable in the food sector, and also for crop uses outside of food. So, you know, renewable energy, fiber, and livestock feed are important areas for agriculture today and going forward. Those markets have been more severely impacted than for foods which are primarily used as a, you know, as a food product for consumers, such as permanent crops. So that is one overall trend. But in addition, as a result of this volatility in the global economy, we've also seen the dramatic currency shocks, which are important across a range of U.S. agricultural investments, and we'll comment on those permanent crop impacts in a moment. But overall, what this has meant is that has provided some short-term headwinds to U.S. agricultural exports. Since this slide was put together, though, we've actually seen a little bit of moderation and weakening in the dollar, and hopefully as we get back to a sign of reopening, that we can have some easing in the global currency markets and get back to closer where we were. One really important consideration, though, for ag markets and ag investments is the timing of cash flows that occur from agriculture. So in the case of the Southern Hemisphere, this spring, during the height of the COVID pandemic, they were experiencing their harvest. And so their crops were coming off into an environment of weakened demand and questions around logistics and trade interruptions. But for the Northern Hemisphere, where your investments are located, we still have a number of months to go until harvest. And for U.S. ag products overall, the greatest months for exports tend to be located in the fourth quarter and the first quarter of the year. So in some sense, we still have a number of months to go. Hopefully, we can continue to regain momentum in the U.S. and global economy that will provide some tailwinds as far as demand by the time we get to that point in the year, when the cash flow really matters later in the year at harvest time. In addition, the dramatic monetary easing that we've seen, we believe is going to be very supportive for farmland values. So while there might be some short-term reductions on income from some of the commodity prices, interest rates have really been a major driver of farmland values, providing an income return at a premium to a long-term treasury, like the 10-year treasury. And then finally, a couple of key things to keep an eye on really is on the trade front. It has been the topic for the last couple of years. We had a lot of good news at the beginning of 2020 prior to COVID with the signing of the Phase 1 trade agreement with China and the U.S., as well as the USMCA here in North America. But questions about those relationships will be very important, so we're monitoring that closely. And then lastly, one important moderating factor for the U.S. ag sector, apart from the strong fiscal response that we've seen from the federal government, really has to do with crop insurance. So for many of the crops that are in the field today or on the tree or on the vine, the pricing level for insurance in the case of weather events or other crop volatility events was actually set before COVID. And so the payouts to producers for losses incurred in this 2020 growing season will actually be at prices that could be above the current spot market. I want to turn to the next slide, 213, and comment a little bit on the permanent crop markets. As I mentioned before, for agriculture overall, food demand for products which can be stored has really been the most resilient portion of the ag economy. And so the crops that make up your portfolio, almonds, apples, and pistachios, all fit into that category. And as far as immediate impacts from COVID, we did see a slight slide in exports through the end of April, which is our latest available data. However, we had a lot of folks stocking up in grocery stores across the country, And almonds are really a great product that flows well through the retail channel as opposed to that food service channel. And so that shift in the U.S. food consumption here at home domestically from food service to retail has not been a headwind for almonds. However, we have had a little bit of a pullback in exports due to some of the transportation challenges in other countries having shutdowns. But again, we are seeing renewed openings around the world. One comment, I think, around global markets that is really relevant to share here is that the U.S. is over 80% of global almond production, and then we export nearly 75% of what's produced in the U.S. for almonds. And so although there are issues where currency can play a role, at the end of the day, for consumers looking for almonds and in the plant-based protein trend, the U.S. is really the global source for that product. Looking forward for the U.S. almond crop, one thing that will be interesting this year will be continued growth in supply. So in permanent crops, given the multi-year period of development, we've had a lot of increase in production, favorable margins and trends providing the type of returns in your portfolio. And so what we're keeping an eye on is really that export demand here in 2020 and whether or not the global economy has any impact on that. So far, exports for the marketing year to date have continued to rise over the prior year. Turning to the apple market, we did have a larger crop and should mention across all these crops that harvest size is really a big driver of price. I'm sure there's some volatility there year to year. In the apple market, we had a larger crop than last year. But looking through the marketing year that began in August, we've seen fresh apple exports have increased over last year and over the five-year average. A lot of this is owing partially to more available apple production, but also much better trade conditions, particularly into Canada and Mexico, where we had seen a severe curtailment during the height of the trade war in 2018 and 2019. So I think that having better trade relations is really important for our fresh apple exports, particularly here in North America. The pistachio market is in a little bit of a different scenario at the moment because last fall's harvest was an off-year harvest. So you really see this surge between smaller crops, larger crops, much like pecans, for those of you familiar with pecans in Texas. And so the pistachio crop last year was already quite smaller. Prices have held up well. The key factor in pistachios will be really U.S.-China relations. Pistachios are heavily concentrated to China, Hong Kong, and Macau, relative to many other U.S. ag products. But the U.S. does represent more than half of global production of pistachios, so it really remains the preferred supplier with not too many other competitors that China could potentially turn to. So those are some of the key points of what we're seeing in the ag markets today. I'd be glad to answer any questions as well.
Okay, thanks, Dan. If there are no questions, we'll continue moving on to take a little bit of a forward look for performance, and then I would like to make sure we spend a little bit of time on water because you have a heavily concentrated portfolio in California, and water is a big factor for investments in California. So if we move on to slide 2014, Dan laid out some of the reasons why we still feel that these are good markets to be in, but when we look forward, we're still forecasting the TMPC portfolio to meet budgeted expectations. 2020 will be an on year for pistachios, so we expect large yields on the California properties in particular, which should drive good income returns. But there are risks, and as Dan just indicated, some of the geopolitical trade concerns in the global economic environment surrounding the COVID impacts do remain risks and water as well. We move on to, excuse me for a second if my throat's a little drying up, so I'm starting to cough a bit. We move on to slide 215. We'll start putting some data around our projections. On a go-forward basis, we still believe that the go-forward IRR of the portfolio is slightly over 10%. And that's assuming that we, a hypothetical purchase of the property at today's market value and our income projections going forward.
And this is primarily driven by the income expectations on the California properties in particular. The almond and pistachio projections for your portfolio are the main cash drivers. The apple property in the portfolio will see a needed redevelopment over the next, say, 5 years or so, and so that'll really produce income in the, you know, the latter half of our 25-year forecast here. When we move to the next slide, you'll see how this looks on a cash flow basis. And, you know, we've separated the portfolio into the three basic crops there, apples, pistachios, and almonds. And what you'll see is that the main driver of your performance going forward will be the apple, the pistachio and the almond crop. And the apples will really start to pay off in the late 2020s going forward. You know, there, this redevelopment aspect of the apple properties is important, is necessary. Apples are facing a bit of a redevelopment crunch across the entire industry due to consumer demands, primarily around varietals. I suspect that you folks on the phone have become more educated around apple varietals. I mean, I certainly have as well over the last 5 to 10 years, and we're certainly more aware of the difference between Honeycrisp versus Cosmic Crisp versus, say, Fuji's. If you went back, say, 10, 15 years ago, people really just thought of apples as, you know, red and green. So there's a bit more of a consumer focus on certain varietals, and that's leading to a bit of a repositioning of apple for apple assets when the trees get to a certain age. And so the property in the TMBC portfolio is going through that now. We still think the apple property is strategic to the overall portfolio, particularly given how concentrated in pistachios and almonds this portfolio is. The apples are a different weather pattern, different demand pattern, different global market, and so it provides some nice diversification to an otherwise concentrated portfolio.
It looks like a negative cash flow for the next 5 years or so. I mean, longer term you can afford it, but are we better off? What would the market value of this be relative to what we're carrying it at?
I think now the market value is likely close to what you're carrying it at. You're likely, I'm not as up to speed on this detail, I can get it to you shortly after the call. Your market value is likely close to bare land value because the trees are aged. And so we do think it is important and worthwhile to maintain through the redevelopment to at least get to a point where if you don't want to keep it for the long term, sell it when it's retooled. So it would be a cash flow and attractive producing asset. Apples have a long development curve, and that is one of the aspects and one of the challenges of the apple crop in particular is that they tend to take 7 to 10 years before they reach maturity.
But you think we could recover whatever that development cost is longer term?
And at this point, we would expect that, yes.
Okay, thanks.
So I do want to go to the next slide before we get into water because it is important. So if you look at slide 217, to understand a little bit about pistachio properties, whereas the column chart on 216 seems fairly smooth, pistachios do have an on-off alternate bearing behavioral pattern. So 1 year they produce a high crop, the next year they produce a low crop. This is a natural aspect of pistachios. Lots of crops do this, but pistachios do it, in a much more amplified fashion. So over your experience and going forward, what you will notice is, income returns on your pistachio crops increasing significantly, decreasing significantly in on-off years. I should say it might not be income return, but you can expect your yield and to some extent cash flow to reflect that on-off variety. Prices do tend to reflect the on-off years, so that helps smooth this out a little bit. But going forward, you will see some annual volatility around the pistachio net income, and that'll be a particular factor in your portfolio given how heavily allocated it is to pistachios. I don't believe you should take away from this that it's a cause for concern. We don't think that it is. This is something that you've lived with to this point and you will continue to live with going forward. But I think it is important for you to know and just understand that given the concentration levels of your portfolio, you will see this income volatility. And it's important to keep in context with some of the things that we'll be managing your portfolio through, which brings us to water. You have a heavy allocation to water in California, and it's a big area of focus for us, as you probably imagine. And so I'd like to throw it over to Carl Evers to walk us through water policy in California and how we're managing it.
Thanks, Rick. And we can jump to slide 218, please. Thanks for having me on the call. I'm glad to be able to participate, even though it's virtually. So as Rick has mentioned, you know, given the portfolio's weighting in California, thought it'd be worthwhile to just provide a brief update on the ever-evolving water management situation in California. So first, I'd like to just give a brief overview on the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act, or SGMA as it's called, and then we can talk about how H&RG has been managing California water in light of the new act, and then, you know, finally get to what the implementation of this act means for TMPC. So in attempt to briefly summarize SGMA, as it's called, the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act was passed into California law in 2014, and really the aim was to set a framework for the sustainable management of groundwater by the year 2040. And there's several important milestones that are going to occur between 2014 and 2040. Because California has so many unique and varied hydrologic conditions throughout the state, it was recognized in the law that the local control and administration of California groundwater was going to be the necessary path for this law to be successful. And so, per the law, groundwater sustainability agencies, or GSAs as you will hear them called, were formed within each groundwater sub-basin in 2017 for the high priority sub-basins, and then 2019 for medium and low. And they were given the task to develop groundwater sustainability plans, or GSPs as they're called, by January 31st of this year. And then those plans were to be submitted to the California Department of Water Resources. And so, you know, what is sustainability? And really in the act, it's sustainability is achieved by the avoidance of 6 undesirable results of groundwater management. And so, you know, highlighting of those 6, there's the inclusion of not depleting groundwater storage, not degrading groundwater quality, or not incurring land subsidence. And those are sort of the most applicable to farmland. So how exactly the sustainability is achieved is left to each of these individual GSAs to decide in their plan. But really the Department of Water Resources will be reviewing these plans over the next 2 years, and they'll have the authority to determine if they're adequate or not, so that there is a backstop. And so just if they're deemed not sustainable, the GSAs will be given by the state a probationary status and then, you know, a preset list of requirements to get them in compliance so that the control can always really remain on the local level. And then if we want to jump to slide 219, you know, just talking about H&RG's function here. So H&RG, as we've talked about, has been managing assets in California for several decades. And so our experience here meant that we were equipped with the necessary expertise and relationships to really ensure our clients are successful in adapting to this new law. You know, I'm born and raised Californian, so because we are used to operating in California, we've been adapting to new laws or new technologies as long as we've been operating here. I'll just highlight a few of the things that H&RG specifically has been doing to be proactive in managing Cigna. So in 2016, we retained New Currents Water and Land and continue to work with them today as a strategic advisor in California water policy. New Currents is a partnership of legal and technical water experts with a really long professional history in California water. And, you know, they really assist us in our prioritization of which GSAs or which policy discussions to be engaged in. And then, you know, we've hired 3 full-time employees that are fully dedicated to managing water resources. All 3 of us have involvement in California, and one of those employees is completely dedicated to just California. So we have been attending and will continue to attend GSA and water district meetings, you know, where we have the opportunity to actively engage in policy development discussions. And, you know, as these groundwater sustainability plans were formed, there were a lot of Hancock employees in the room guiding the discussions on how to set sustainability guidelines. And, you know, that will obviously be a big benefit to the clients. And then what I sort of find most fun, we've been busy developing and implementing water management tools on farm so that, you know, as this law evolves, we can optimize the water resources of our client assets in Lima Sigma. Some of those highlights include developing groundwater recharge projects, as there's a picture on the slide here, groundwater credit and trading systems, the development of new or just the improvement of existing surface water supplies, and then the development of any alternative land use options should fallowing of farmed acres become necessary down the road. And then we can jump to 220, please. So I think most importantly, you know, what does Sigma and all of this mean for TNPC? And it's actually pretty good news at the moment. You know, TNP's portfolio is well positioned to operate through the implementation of Sigma. You know, we've kept some really good assets, and the majority of the properties in this portfolio are located within those GSAs that do not call for a significant reduction of groundwater pumping in their GSPs. And, you know, what that really means is that we should see the ability to operate at a similar level of production that the properties have in the past, and not that shouldn't be materially impacted by Sigma. And, you know, importantly, the majority of these properties have access to surface water or they benefit from surface water projects in a district. So, you know, I guess although you'll likely see a lot of doom and gloom news headlines about California groundwater, you know, focusing on the fact that sustainability is achieved at a very local level, you know, just know that TNPC is in those right locales to be able to operate through Sigma. And so just as with anything, there's, of course, upsides and downside potential that we really might not know yet. As I mentioned, it's the glide path for this law is implemented from 2014 through 2040. And so really until we're farther down that road of implementation, the likelihood of any of those upsides and downsides is yet to be known. So I guess in closing, it's just important to note we're in a very early stage of a 20-plus year glide path to the full implementation of the Sigma. So there's still a lot that can happen between the submittal of the GSPs earlier this year through really the end of that glide path in 2040. And thus, H&RG is going to continue to monitor and just stay actively engaged in the process so that as policies and opportunities evolve, we will be there to ensure the best possible outcome for TNPC's California farms. We've been comfortably managing crazy California water for a long time, and we're comfortable we're able to continue to provide our clients with the necessary expertise to succeed in California. And that's all I have, unless there's any questions. So thanks for your time, and then I think you can go back to Rick.
Okay, anybody have any questions for the group? Good presentation.
Thank you. Yeah, and you know, we I think Carl's comments speak for themselves. We do fundamentally believe that your portfolio is well positioned, not only in commodities that are attractive in the U.S., but also in the unique water situation in California. We do think you remain well positioned. So, we're excited for what the future holds for this portfolio, and we expect it to continue performing, similar to how it has performed in the past.
Great. We should eat more pistachios, I guess, huh?
Absolutely.
Okay, thanks, guys. I think if there's no questions, we will let these guys go back to their day jobs.
Thank you all very much. Have a wonderful day.
Thank you.
Okay, next, we are about to go into session, but I think we'll just see if anybody in the public has any comments they want to share with the board before we go into closed session. So, what is it? Hit 5 and star if you want to ask a question or speak for a little bit.
Yes, on your phone, press 5 star.
Okay. Is anything there, John?
No one requested to talk.
Okay. So we're going to go into closed session now. We probably for the bulk of the rest of the meeting. I think we will come back and open just for one motion on the trustee agenda item that's on there. So we can go into closed session and have the folks that are public comment. I guess they can either sign off or John, do you want to give any instructions on what else needs to be done?
I'll move them to the waiting room. If they want to stick around, I'll bring them back in when we go into public to open session again. As you said, there's probably not much going to happen.
Yep. Okay, I'll give you a minute to accomplish that, putting people in the waiting room.